Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Batabile Mtombeni, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. This week, I am delighted to welcome newly minted author Brandon Lacey Compass to the show. I'm sure we're in for a raucous time. Brandon is known for his straightforward, no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is approach to speaking his mind, and we are going to talk today about what's on it. You are listening to part two of a piece called Journey Through the Cosmic Blue Night Forest from saxophone virtuoso Roz Mache's album Into the Openness. This is elemental music, sort of in the tradition of Sun Ra and Butch Morris's conductions with the New Blue Orchestra, although Roz is certainly a tradition unto himself. So sit back, take a listen, and enjoy. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, and I'm your host, Batabile Mtombeni, couples and divorce mediator. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If you have an issue that just won't go away, work it out in couples mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I can guide you through the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. If you have issues with child support and parenting or visitation, give me a call or send me an email at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. My guest today is poet and published author Brandon Lacey Compass, and I'd like to send out a special welcome to all the folks who are listening to the show right now at Brandon's book signing party out there on the West Coast. I know you're in the other room, but I want to hear you cheer. All right, I'm sure they're cheering. We can't hear them because, first of all, I have Brandon's mic off for the moment, and they're in the next room. But I'm hoping that they are nicely loud and raucous for Brandon. And Brandon, your mic is now on. But I'm going to take a moment to do a little bit more in terms of welcome and then come to you. I'd also like to welcome my newest friends from South Africa. Last week was South Africa Friend Fest on Facebook, so I'm happy to welcome you all as well. And to my regular listeners, you know how much you mean to me. So thank you so much for dropping by this afternoon. If you'd like to call into the show, dial 818-532-9789. That's 818-532-9789. We do have a chat room this week, so look for the instructions on how to join the chat room. If you're logged online, you're listening to the show online, then you're already half of the way there. There are instructions there on how to join the chat room. And there you can chat with other listeners and ask questions or make comments. I do stop by from time to time, and I can get your questions and comments on the air. And that's great for those of you who are a little on the shy side. So, when I was planning the Mother's Day show a few months ago, I put out a request to musicians and poets who had written songs or poems about mothers to appear on the show. A good friend of mine named Kamal Fazazi suggested that I contact a poet friend of his named Brandon Lacey Kemper. Little did I know that Kamal was setting me up for quite a raucous ride with this young man who is now a published poet. And Brandon is just one of those people I love to be around because his energy is just so wonderful. So when I heard that he was about to publish a book, I jumped on the chance to have him here on the show. And here we are. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here with you. Yay!
Yay! It's finally happening. So how does it feel to be published?
It's amazing. I mean, this particular book has been 4 years in the making, and there were stops and starts, and my previous publisher went bankrupt. So the fact that it's like, you know, here and ready to go and happened, it's kind of crazy. I'm like, oh my Lord. And it's poetry during a recession. Who publishes poetry in a recession?
Yeah.
Like it's really amazing. I love it. And I love being privileged to have my own book of poetry out, you know, like poetry for me is a labor of love. It's awesome.
Wow. Listen, I know from your bio that you've been writing poetry for quite some time. And we can talk a little bit about that, what started you on your journey. But what finally prompted you to say, look, I'm going to put this together, put it in a book, and put it out during a recession?
Well, I have actually another book coming out. And I have to say, I have walked a blessed road in terms of being a published author in that I haven't had to go the regular rejection route. And so the way this book was originally conceived was a friend of mine who I went to undergrad with, who I hadn't been in touch with since I left my first college in 1997, Maureen McDowell, she actually was reading my blog and heard and read some of my poetry that I had up. And she and her husband had started a small publishing house. And she emailed me and said, you know, I really love your poetry. Would you be interested in talking with us about doing a book? She said, no, I can't make the decision myself. There's four people that have to sign off on it. But if all four of us sign off on it, you know, we'd love to publish your work.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I was like, oh, okay. And at the time, I had just begun dating my former partner and still amazing good friend, David Berube, whose art's in the book. He had come to visit me in Minneapolis, and he was doing a series called the Face of Day series, where he literally would see someone on the street in New York and then go and do a linoleum cut print of their face.
Huh.
And he had brought some of his prints with him, and I saw them, and I said, you know, I was just approached about doing a book. I was like, I would love to have your art in this book if my publisher is amenable to it. And I sent copies of some of his prints to my publisher, and they were like, absolutely. And
yeah.
So not only do you get poetry in the book, but for every poem, there's one of David's linoleum cut prints, and they're spectacular. So even if you're not a poetry lover, but you're an art lover, it's like a twofer.
Absolutely. You know, and I can attest to that because I got my own advanced copy. I felt so special. But I got my own advanced copy and got to see that, and the juxtaposition, you know, the choices of what print goes with what work of poetry is really important and special as well. You've done a great job with that. Why don't we just dive in a little bit and hear something from the book? Let's give folks who are listening a little bit of a sample, and then we'll continue talking about your journey as a poet and your journey into authorship. Would you mind reading The Streets?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. this piece is called These Streets, and I wrote this a long time ago, actually. I've been down these streets before, walked them so many times. My feet need no directions, no every sidewalk, crack houses, weeping flakes of paint like sunburned skin. Vibrancy, a long-gone memory, these colors are barely surviving, but the patterns left behind tell stories. Plainly there for anyone that can read the street patois, the pig Latin of the ghetto, that gives young eyes the gift of x-ray vision, lets them see the roots beneath the sidewalk, through the sagging sheets hanging in the windows, beyond the rib cages of yard dogs, skin stretched tight, kinship found in hungry canine eyes. I've been down these streets before, walked down them so many times, watched dreams cash for rent money, watched rent money cash for a dream high, watched the junkie prophet proclaim prophecy, whispered in his ears by the monkey on his back, toothy grinning, picking hopes like lice, lips smacking the monkey savers. Each one whispers and waves as the street opens up, swallows them whole. I step over the chalk outline, the street grave marked, refiscat in pace, a memorial until the next rain or morning piss. I've been down these streets before, seen single mothers press bottles of Similac into mouths, screaming umbilical rage as fathers have found peace and fists pounded into pregnant bellies, into the girl next door, high school sweethearts, white picket fences that never lined these streets, lined fantasies and heads. Nobody told us that white picket fences were meant to keep us out. Loan denied, bad credit, pickets turned into red lines, my bodies hurled against them, fences made of white steel, reinforced, indivisible, liberally distributed, one nation divided in two, all for some and little for us. I've been down these streets before because these streets paved my mind, a city built and peopled by our fears, the can't-dos and the can-nots, the not-qualified enoughs. You speak so eloquently, the relapses, the system tracking, the racial profiling, the unemployment. On these streets, there ain't no schools, only prisons. On these streets, every home is broken and no way to fix them. On these streets, segregation has been perfected. It is illegal to sit with yourself. High treason to ask yourself why. Premeditated murder to come up with your own answers. Sedition to better yourself. Your only choices, drugs, jail, or death, all available without a prescription. And that's These Streets.
Wow. You know, that poem seems to talk about being raised by the streets, what it is to have your primary influence be the streets of a particular kind of neighborhood. And, of course, we'll talk a bit about what informs that, but I am curious about who raised you. Your acknowledgments prominently feature family members, aunts and grandmas especially, and I remember the poem for your honey bun that you shared with us on the Mother's Day show. What role has your family played in your growth as a writer?
Sorry, I just got really emotional. Sorry.
Well, talk to me about that. What's going on?
So the honey bun who I read the poem about recently passed away.
Yes.
And I've had amazing, amazing people in my life, especially my family. And so they figure in a lot into my, not even into the writing, but, I grew up dirt poor. I mean, really, I'm substantially working class with a rich family history, but with few resources. And the one thing that my family always did for me and with me was to instill the fact that despite the circumstance, I could do anything I wanted, whatever that was. It didn't matter if I wanted to build model cars or, you know, study abroad. It didn't matter. I have a really complicated family history, largely having part of blended families and divorces and family of choice. But the richness that I've always had is the family that's been around me. And so for me, in the acknowledgments, it was necessary to honor those people because I couldn't – I wouldn't be alive or be who I am without them. And so people like Honey Bun, and who was my great aunt but raised my dad, and, you know, for example, in her funeral acknowledgments, he was listed as her son, like Mona, who Miss Mona Harris, who was in this book. She was the mom of one of my best friends, but she was, like, I spent holidays with them, and she always believed in me from a young age, to, like, you know, my own birth mother and my birth father and the abusive stepfather that raised me and my stepmother, who is as equal to me, Melanie, as my own birth mother. And I've had this wealth of family. And, you know, I'm in L.A. right now for a book party. And my little sister, who, bless her heart, is deployed right now in the Middle East, you know, paid for the ticket. You know, like, I mean, just my family has been so, so supportive through every aspect of my life, that none of this, particularly no success I've had, would legitimately be possible without these family members who have been my personal angels, who have stepped in, appeared when I needed them, and even when I didn't know I needed them, they've been there. And so that's why, you know, I write about them, and that's why I honored them in the beginning of the book. In my novel that's coming out, Honey Bun is a central character, because I knew she was gonna die from cancer. And so I want, whenever I have the opportunity, I want the world to know that there's these amazing people walking around who've been a part of my life. And so while I may have some level of recognition, it's only because there's these tremendous people who have lifted me up and held me up and believed in me, even in times that I couldn't believe in myself. And so that's why family plays such a key role and presence in my writing, and also in the acknowledgement of how I've had the privilege to be a published author now.
Wow. Yeah, there are many ways, I guess, of being rich. And nobody wishes poverty on anyone else, but to grow up in a situation where you might be money poor, resources poor in terms of material wealth, but to have the wealth of a family that supports you, that says that, you know, these deficits that you have growing up don't have to stop you, that is a kind of wealth that money can't buy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of my only regrets about this book is that it didn't come out before Honey Bun passed away. Mm. I would have loved to give her a copy and let her know that, you know, this is possible because, you know, when my dad's mom died of cancer at a young age, you stepped in and raised him to be a good man, and he, you know, made me possible. And so, you know, like, this is a product of generations and of love and of richness that absolutely has nothing to do with money in the bank, but of spirit and support. And so, yeah, absolutely. Like, I've walked many roads in my life, and I know lots of folks of many different class strata, and I wouldn't, like, poverty can be temporary. I've always been fed, but I wouldn't give up my family for anything.
Of course. Right. And, you know, your sense of history and your appreciation for heritage are obvious. And I want to talk a little bit about that as well, about your heritage. You know, you were driving up from the South from Honey Bun's funeral on Mother's Day when you appeared on the show and read your poem. You talk like a Southern boy, yet there are all these references to Minnesota. What's all that about?
So it's really interesting. I'm very ethnically mixed, but both sides of my family, my mom's family was a Mayflower family. My dad's family, we know legitimately because of slave records and receipts that my dad's family has been in this country since 1709. So I also have that privilege where, especially for a black family, most folks, because of the legacy of slavery, unless they're recent immigrants from Africa, have no, like, they, there's like a legitimate point where their history just stops because of the slave trade, because of buying and selling of people's bodies. And because my family were slaves in West Virginia, which was a mill-based slavery, which families were not broken up, I have this awesome connection both to the South, which is where my dad's family grew up. And my dad went to high school with the descendants of the family that owned our family.
My goodness.
One of my favorite stories, I have a brilliant and amazing cousin, older cousin named Carol, who's a lawyer in New Orleans, but she does research on black families in West Virginia. And she was telling me a story about how she was on a research trip and met with some of the descendants of the family that owned us, and they still to this day have on their wall a lithograph of my the poem Big Sam is about my great grandfather, and they still have a lithograph of him on their wall because he was their favorite slave. So the narrative there is just, I was like, please let him down. And then on the other side, my mom's family co-founded my hometown of Duluth in northern Minnesota, which is now the fourth largest city in Minnesota. So that's where I was raised. So I have this deep connection both to the utter far north of the United States and, you know, and then the South. And my family, you know, my family's a product of both. And I went to college in the South, and I grew up as a community organizer in the South. And so the narrative based on geography is very present in my life, even when I'm not physically present in the geography that might be associated with, you know, my history. And so, I mean, that's sort of where, you know, people often say, oh, my God, you sound like you're from the South, but you're from Duluth. I'm like, well, I know. It's just present. It's present in my family. It's present in my history. And I love it. I love both. I love the South. It's, you know, South, for me, the South is family and Minnesota's family. And if I could find some way to meld the two together, like lutefisk with collard greens, it'd be fabulous.
Wow. Well, you know, it sounds as though you of all people embody what it is to be quintessentially American. In the sense of having all of these various histories mixed together, and you know, they come out in this wonderful person that is you.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Listen, folks, we're going to take a short break. It actually is already that time, believe it or not. I found a piece to play for you during the break that is absolutely perfect for what we're talking about. It is by a group that I featured a few weeks ago on the 4th of July show, which actually aired on July 3rd. And this is the group called the Mighty Third Rail, and the piece is called Order of the Pen. Listen up, and you will understand why I picked this particular piece. I'll be back with you in just a moment.
Scribble. Right, right. Right, you're an eight, they say you're crazy. You got rattling your fingers and snap, and you got cool to crack. Cause the only way you know to make sense is society is static, and that's why everything you go at is right. Right, 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 right. Now put me down, give praise to the pen, and tomorrow we'll start again, and in your dreams you hear. S-C-R-I-B-B-L-E. Scribble. That's correct.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the personal, social, and financial issues that concern you most. I'm your host, Batabi Levantombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. And yes, folks, I'm not kidding you, we are live. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If you have an issue that just won't go away, work it out in couples mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting or visitation issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. That's www.123untangled.com. The piece you heard during the break is called Order of the Pen, and it is from a group called the Mighty Third Rail, this awesome New York-based group, and their album is called Classic. It's their first album. They have two albums out now, but both of them are available for purchase on iTunes. I hope that you check them out, buy their music. These guys have a lot of profound things to say, and they say it profoundly. Folks, I have an important, very important, and unfortunately distressing announcement to make. Daniel Bobbis, who is a high school teacher and the surf team coach at Long Beach High School here in New York, has gone missing off the coast of Sumatra in Indonesia. He was out surfing. They have found his board. But they have not found him, and he's been missing for well over 10 hours now. I would put it perhaps more like close to 20 hours. According to published reports, they have found his surfboard, as I said, but they have found no sign of him. His wife, Rachel, who is in Indonesia, has desperately sought help, and it seems that help is unfortunately scarce right now. I actually contacted the duty officer for the American Embassy in Jakarta. Her name is Mrs. Carter. And I spoke with her a few hours ago. She tells me that the embassy does not have the resources to mount a search and that she was able to give Rachel Bobbis the contact information for three helicopter companies that could fly out and look for Daniel. The Bobbis family needs your help. If you are able to help, if you happen to know people in Sumatra or you'd like to offer help in some other way, send me an email at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. And I will let you know how you can be in touch and offer whatever help you can. That email address one more time is info@123untangled.com. Please do keep this family in your thoughts. I am talking with Brandon Lacey Campos, the author of a new book of poems called It Ain't the Truth If It Doesn't Hurt. If you'd like to join in the conversation, call 818-532-9789. That's 818-532-9789. Or join in the chat room. If you are listening to the show online, you are already logged in, and you can follow the instructions there to see how you can join the chat room. I pop over there from time to time to see what's going on, if there are any questions or conversation going on that I can bring onto the air. So, Brandon, your mic is back on. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And I have to say I'm getting 14 different kinds of electronic communication from the co-collaborator on the book saying, but if you want to buy the book, you can either go to rebelsatoripress.com or amazon.com to get the book.
Absolutely.
I've got a text message.
I'm not going to touch you on that one. There was talks of that, but go ahead and do that now. This would be a perfect time to give information about how to order the book, how to obtain the book. So go ahead.
So the book is available for pre-order now at www.rebelsatoripress.com, which is rebelsatoripress.com, or via amazon.com. And it's called It Ain't Truth If It Doesn't Hurt. It'll be available as an e-download sometime in the next few weeks, and it actually will be available in your local, or I don't know if your local bookstore, but in the bookstore, after the 27th is when it actually will physically be available. But right now it's available for pre-order. You know, help a poet out, buy a book. and I'll remind you, it's a twofer. If you love art, you get some amazing prints. If you love poetry, you get poetry. If you love both, you get poetry and a print, and for the low price of $15.95.
Oh, that's wonderful. We say a nice shout-out to David right there.
Hey, David. He's listening and sending me sassy text messages and emails.
Well, that's wonderful, and I thank him for, you know, putting that in, that reminder, that nudge to do that. We're going to go ahead and repeat that message further on the show. And then I will let you know how you can access the blog that is related to the show where you can get this information. So if you're driving or if you happen to be somewhere where you don't have access to a pen and paper to write down this information, that's fine. That information will be available electronically online for your convenience. So I will let you know how to access the blog a little bit later in the show. Now, Brandon, the title of your book is It Ain't the Truth If It Doesn't Hurt. Why do you say that? Does the truth have to hurt?
So the original inspiration, my very first blog ever was called It Ain't Truth If It Doesn't Hurt, which was inspired by a collection of essays by Barbara Smith. And for folks who don't know Barbara Smith, she is the architect of black radical feminism in the United States. So she had a collection out called The Truth That Never Hurts. And part of my own life experience is when I am being completely honest with myself and honest about the world, that even the sweetest truths have a little bit of hurt to them, right? Like even things that, I mean, that's just my, so the title comes from my personal experience. It's saying that, like, if I'm being honest about where I am and who I am, there is beauty and there's pain in every one of those moments. Those times where I am unable to accept both sides of that realistic coin, that I'm not accepting the truth of a moment. And so, for example, I just realized that I ran out to the living room during the break, and one of my amazing and loved friends, Taylor, has arrived. But I walked out, and I was like, why was I about to cry? Earlier, and I realized the last time that I spoke publicly about my honey bun was when I talked to you on the call, that, you know, after her funeral. And in that moment, I was like, the truth of this moment is, this is a celebratory, transformative, amazing moment in my life, but there's pain there, and the pain is related to this other experience, and that whole reality is the truth. And so there is a hurt that is involved, I think, with every truth in life. Whether it's a deep hurt or shallow hurt, hurt doesn't mean bad.
Okay.
It just means that there is something, or some way or some moment that got you to where you are that requires some sort of sacrifice or growth.
Okay.
And just like when I was a teenager and my knees hurt from growing, that hurt wasn't bad, but it was a part of the process. And so for me, getting to truth is a process that often requires uncomfortability. And so that is the piece of it, that if you are actually being real about whatever the truth is, there was hurt to get there.
So then, again, you're saying that in order to really understand the wonderful things about life and the challenging things about life, you have to be able to recognize and acknowledge and accept and perhaps even embrace the challenging aspects that may bring some pain with them.
Absolutely.
I mean, you think about one of the most beautiful experiences in life, which is childbirth. And it is also one of the most excruciating experiences a human being can endure.
Absolutely. That's a perfect metaphor.
All right. Well, you spoke a little bit earlier about a certain truth, and the truth that your father's side of the family was enslaved and that you have records and receipts. Oh, my goodness. You have receipts.
Right.
Recording that. And that you actually have, contact with the family that owned your father's family or enslaved your father's family, and that there's this portrait, this lithograph, you said, hanging in the living room of their favorite slave, Big Sam. And you've written a poem about Big Sam. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Sure. And let me give you the background. So it wasn't probably until 2007, I think it was, that I actually knew the name of the family that owned us. And it was Miss Carol, who's a distant cousin. We share our great-great-grandparents. My great-great-grandmother was her great-great-grandfather's sister. And she's been this wealth and this blessing and this gift of history for us. She was the one who told me the name of the family that owned us. And I remember, clearly, I was in my office. I worked for this amazing national organization called Camp Heartland, which is the largest camp that provides services to children and families impacted by HIV and AIDS. Mm. And I was on a staff where there's only one other person of color. And I got up and closed my office door. It's one thing to have a nondescript anger about, you know, having your family having been slaves and the legacy of slavery. It is another thing to have a name. And I was like, please, Jesus, if I meet someone on the street named Nick, Kelly, if somebody gives me a nickel, if I see a nickel plated something, I'm going to go to jail.
Okay.
Because I'm going to kill it. I'm just going to do it. So when she told me the story, and then she made it, I mean, God bless Miss Carol, I hope she's listening. It got even worse when she told me about Big Sam, who was their favorite slave, and she said the Nichols family back in the 40s, I think, published a book on their family history. And in the book, there's a chapter called The Darkies, which is all about my family.
Oh.
So I was like, they got a picture of him on the wall. They wrote something called The Darkies, and I got a name, and then I called my dad. My dad's like, oh, high school to Nichols. I said, oh, I'm about to have a deep moment.
Uh-oh.
And so for my own personal survival and for me not going Cougars McGee on some people that, you know, in West Virginia, I wrote this poem.
Okay.
So this poem is called Big Sam.
Okay.
I got an email the other day from Miss Carol Haynes, a newfound cousin. She wrote, the Nichols were the family who owned us and when we were slaves. And while most of us got free, Big Sam is still in chains. Big Sam was a good nigger man, according to the chapter called The Darkies in the Nichol family history. Legend has it that Big Sam was the best team-driving man in Greenbrier County. One day he turned a team of horses around in a narrow alleyway, and a white man offered to pay top dollar to buy that good nigger. And I wonder if Big Sam looked at that white man and thought it would be so easy to kill him, to turn loose his team and run him over, pound his white skin into the dirty stone of this street, turn the horses and circle after circle until his pale pink skin is dark, but not like mine. His skin will be bruised, dirty, the color of shit ground into snow. It would never be, could never be the deep shades of ebony, onyx, sun-kissed carbon that is my holy African inheritance. I wonder if he thought those things while he samboed and through gritted teeth, words digging double hands in the flesh of his tongue as he said, thank you, sir. Miss Carol's email continued, said she'd spoken with a Nichol descendant that said, Big Sam was such a good Negro man that my sister keeps a picture of him on her wall. And I wonder if Big Sam's ghost looks out of that photo, his spirit raging in 150 years of hanging, swinging by an invisible noose, watching television and screaming at the Gina 6, that professor at Columbia, that pickup truck in Alabama, and all the nooses visible and invisible hanging around the necks of his people, his children, his familial diaspora. Does he call on Jemejan, Oshun, Legba, and Ogun? Does he demand that Jesus climb down from his cross and take up his father's Old Testament solutions, fire, salt, boils, locusts, the bellies of whales? Does his spirit refuse to kneel before the throne of God because his knees were bent for too damn long? Does he stand outside of heaven's gates, refusing to come in until his picture comes down? And I wonder if he had found the peace that passes my understanding, if he can laugh and cry at the circumstances of his life, if he can turn the other cheek, if he can tell me how to calm the fire raging deep within me in places dark, wet, primal that I never knew existed until the day I learned the name of our former slave masters, until I had a target for my sometimes inarticulate pen, the why behind my need to sing spirituals, not of escaping but taking back the spirit, beaten, hung, swung, raped, worked, and sold out of my grandparents, why at 30 the internet knows more than I know about my own family. And I wonder if Big Sam is waiting for me like he waited for Loma, Juanita, and Drusilla. Did he meet them just the other side of the setting sun and welcome them home? Did he watch as they shed skins that once imprisoned them? Did he hold them as he shouted, hollered, tore at their own throats to release their pain and joy, their fear and confusion? Did he walk them along that dark, uneven path towards understanding? Catch them as they stumbled, stop them as they contemplated running back over the horizon to the bondage of the familiar, the safety found in constant aching. And I wonder how to rescue Big Sam, how to set free my great-great-great-grandfather, how to tear down the wall showing up with strange fruit, my blood, my history. And I wonder if it's really Big Sam that needs freeing. That's Big Sam.
Hmm. You know, listening to you read that and hearing the obvious emotion in your voice, it leads me to ask this question that I know some people may be asking. It's not a question that necessarily comes from me directly, but it's one that I think ought to be addressed, which is this. You're not a slave now. This is, you know, several generations ago that this happened, and yet you feel it as though it were happening to you now today. What contributes to that?
You know, I think it's a complicated question, and I see the legacy of it. You know, it's while the actual enslavement of my family ended with the Emancipation Proclamation, it actually ended when West Virginia seceded from Virginia. I remember my honey bun telling me a story about she never admitted it, but my favorite story that she told was in the 60s when Brown versus the Board of Education came down, some black parents burned down the Negro school so that they could never send their kids back.
Oh, my.
Yep, that was 40 years ago. So while slavery itself ended in 1865 or 1867, if you're in Texas, 40 years ago, my aunt, who I knew and grew up with, had to burn down a school that represented the legacy of slavery, that maintains the slave condition, that kept black people in a particular circumstance, that maintained white hegemony, that she risked her life, and literally her life. Like, if she had been caught, or if any of them had been caught, they would not have made it. Like, that was 40 years ago. This is a woman who told me the story with her own mouth. So when one of the things that outrages me, when especially when white conservative people talk about slavery ended, you know, 100 and whatever years ago, I'm like, no, actually, Jim Crow was just a continuation of slavery. Mm-hmm. And I heard at the knee what that meant. I've seen, to this day, this woman I love cleaned houses. And at her funeral, I had a white woman tell me at her funeral how she loved my aunt, and it wasn't just because she cleaned her house. And the dynamic and paradigm of the slave legacy was so present at that moment, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, that I was like, please, really tell me again how slavery is not an intimate part of my reality, even though I didn't live it. Please tell me again that story. Please come again when I'm talking to this white woman who's talking about my black aunt who cleaned her house. I'm like, so while the legal condition of slavery has been abolished, the reality for so many people of color in this country, not just black people, but so many people of color in this country, is that low wage, underwage, or underpaid labor, which was the core, which is slavery, either free labor or underpaid labor, is still extant, and it's still a part of the narrative of our lives. So for me, when I read this story, what I'm really reading is, here are all these people that I love and care about that are brilliant and beautiful and funny that have still had to sell their bodies and their spirits to maintain their families at a slave wage.
Hmm.
And that's real. And so that's why when I heard that story, I was like, it's not over. Like, just because a black man's in the White House, it's not over. You know, like conditions have absolutely changed, right? We are no longer in, you know, eating cast-offs and living in a field, but the spiritual constructs around it, that still exists in lots of places. And even for those of us that have had the privilege of education, and my family, my black family is highly educated. Dr. Carter G. Woodson, the man who founded Black History Month, is my great uncle.
Oh,
right?
No.
So like, even
wow.
with that reality, that, like, the still the legacy is there, and it's not generations ago, it's
yeah.
a generation ago.
So you're talking about current continuing social conditions.
Absolutely.
And a spiritual condition as well, as you mentioned.
You know, so that's what makes me angry when people say that. I'm like, it's not generations ago. In actuality, it's a generation ago. You know, like, my dad grew up in the town my dad grew up in is a segregated town to this day. When you get off the highway, you turn right, it's white people. You turn left, it's black people.
Okay.
And that's what's real.
Right,
so,
right. Just out of curiosity, have you ever met the Nichols family?
I personally haven't, no.
Okay. Is it something you might contemplate?
No. I mean, I'm too emotional. I got mad when my dad told me that they went to the high school of the Nichols. He's like, and they're great people. And I was like, I can't even see them as people right now. Like, good for you that you went to high school and you saw them as individuals, and I'm like, I'll punch you in the face. So I should not see them. Like, maybe my niece and nephew can see them or something, or maybe I can see them when I'm 65, but right now, no.
Right.
Let me take that back. Or if they're gonna write me a check for the unpaid labor of my family, I will absolutely see them and forgive them. Yes.
I hear that. I hear you on that, and that is a really interesting concept, because it sounds as though there's something about you and perhaps your place in your family where you have been somehow bestowed with the heaviness of the truth of the legacy, of your family's legacy, and that there is that debt that has not been paid, cannot be paid, perhaps. And so you're mentioning that, you know, if they are able to make up for the unpaid labor, perhaps that would answer to healing the wound that you speak about and addressing this deficit that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the gift and the burden of a writer is that I think every writer on the planet is crazy, like legitimately crazy. I had this conversation earlier with my friend Ebony, with whom I'm staying, and this during this book party, and Jen, her roommate, and they are amazing, and I love them for it. But we're all, like, I think the blessing of the writer is that we feel deeply, and that's the curse of the writer. And so, you know, whether it's the griot tradition that's carried, you know, on, is that it's our gift and burden to feel.
Yeah.
And not to be, I feel, but not, I'm not overwhelmed. Like, I don't walk around angry, but I feel like I hold for my family, the desire and commitment for, reconciliation and recognition of what we have provided to folks that did not deserve what was given. So,
okay. Yeah.
And so I love the fact that my daddy doesn't have to carry that. I love that. I love, love, love that my daddy doesn't, my brothers and sisters don't have to carry it. And I feel like my honey bun was probably a writer who never wrote, because I feel like she carried it.
Okay.
I also have the capacity to carry it. It doesn't break me to carry it. And so I'm okay with carrying it, and I'm okay with not ever wanting to see the Nichols and never wanting to see Big Sam's picture on this wall. Like, God bless Miss Carol, the fact that she visited with these people and saw the picture.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, would have caused a moment of rage. and I would have not been able to circumvent the rage. Miss Pearl could, bless her heart. And because she could, her gift was being able to bring the story back to the rest of us without it causing her pain in a way that didn't allow her to function. For me, I'd have just saw it and started, like, whacking old ladies with a stick. And that's not cute.
Well, you know, as you said, it's a very complicated story. It's going to engender complicated reactions, both internally and then within a family in and of itself. And it, again, just speaks to the complexity of our history as a nation. You know, your family seems to embody it in a particularly poignant way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other part of my family is also Puerto Rican, and I think it's hilarious that my mother's great-uncle, Lieutenant Colonel William Harrison Carey, was a rough rider with Teddy Roosevelt in Puerto Rico. So, one part of the family was colonizing the other. So I am fascinated by the intersection of my own family history and just our history in general in this country. It's hilarious.
Right. Well, and you talked about the burden of being a writer, the particular sense of feeling and so forth that writers have. And I'm curious about when you began to realize that you are a writer, that you are a poet, and when you felt that you had the right, if you will, to call yourself a poet.
Which is really interesting. So in high school, there was a girl. So the poem in my book, Mona, is about Miss Mona Harris, and her daughter, Nicole, remains one of my closest people in the world. And Nicole is the legitimate reason why I realized I was gay.
Okay.
And that's because I realized I was in love with this girl and wanted nothing to do with her physically. And so the way I dealt with those feelings, the conflict, was my junior year, her senior year, I think I wrote her a poem every single day. And I'm sure they were terrible. She's kept them all, and I commanded her never to show them to me because I would die from cheesiness. So I've been writing poetry since the eighth grade, but really as a grown-up poet, I wrote poetry in high school, a little bit in college, and then I didn't really write poetry for a number of years. And it wasn't until I went to International Women's Day spoken word reading at St. Cloud State University. It's called Women Holding Up Half the Sky. It was all women writers, several of whom were good friends of mine, and they were reading their poetry. And that night, I went home and wrote my first spoken word piece, which unfortunately, due to a computer death, I no longer have. But that was, I think, 2003. So as a grown-up poet, as somebody who identifies as a poet as part of their identity, it was in 2003 and was after seeing Women Holding Up Half the Sky, writing this poem, and then starting to read poetry in the rich, very, very rich and supportive poetry community in Minneapolis. Balfi, who actually has a book out very shortly called The Song I Sing, named after his daughter. And Bao is probably the most influential, powerful, and gifted spoken word artist working and writing and living in the United States right now. Mm-hmm. But when folks like Bao and Juliana Pegues and Koya Artichoker and folks started supporting my writing and reading, that's when I felt like I'm a poet, I'm a writer. There was no conflict in that identity. It was just sort of realizing, you know what, this is how I see the world, this is how I deal with the world. And because of Minneapolis is just over-the-top supportive literary community, it was really easy to slip into that identity and have it nurtured.
So you have been able to come out as an artist and as a poet in an atmosphere where it was sort of natural. I mean, you talk about the way that you came to publishing the book, for example, and that your story is a little bit different from convention, if you will. Most people will send their manuscripts to quite a number of publishing houses and experience rejection. You didn't have to experience that in part because you grew up in this fabulous community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the other part of the story about how the book actually got published, I have two friends, Emmanuel Xavier, who is another amazing spoken word artist, and then Charlie Vasquez, who is a novelist, They were with Rebel Satori Press, and I had started writing a novel and sort of had started writing a lot of novels, and this one actually, I was like, oh, crap, I'm actually writing it. They introduced me to their publisher, who bought my novel, which will be out later this year. And
wow.
When my other publisher went bankrupt, Sven, who is the publisher, was in town, and I mentioned that I had this book, and it was complete, but I was going to self-publish it. And he said, no, send it to me. I'll, if I like it, I'll publish it. And he loved it, and so that's why he's publishing it. So it has completely been my community. I mean, you know, this is two other writers with a publisher that ultimately made this happen. And so I'm really blessed of having this amazingly supportive and nurturing community of specifically writers of color and a good portion of queer writers that have seen and supported my work and then opened up venues for me and opportunities that a lot of folks don't have, largely I think because they just don't have access to that type of community. And so I'm very appreciative of the love and support of my community.
Well, Brandon, I feel so privileged to be able to join you in celebrating this wonderful accomplishment, the publication of your book, your book of poetry. And believe it or not, we're down to the end of the show. It's kind of flown by, hasn't it?
That went quickly.
We really are. There are so many other things that I wanted to get into. You do have this other book coming out. Would you consider coming back and perhaps being a guest and we can continue this conversation?
I would love it. And I want to say, I got a note from David asking me to appreciate you. You have been tremendous, and this conversation has been tremendous. So thank you so much, and it's been a privilege, and I would come back anytime for any reason.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Brandon, so much. I want you to have an opportunity, again, to let folks know how they can get the book and tell us about your blog.
Great. So you can get the book either directly from the publisher at Rebel Satori Press, .com, so Satori is Satori, or through Amazon.com, and there'll also be, when I'm not being on vacation in Los Angeles, information on my own blog, which is called My Feet Only Walk Forward, and it's MyFeetOnlyWalkForward.com. You can find me on Facebook at Brandon Lacey Campos or on Twitter at Brandon Lacey Camp, and you can get the book through any of those vehicles.
Right, that's wonderful. And folks, you can tune into, or you can log on to, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. That's untangledresolutions.blogspot.com for more information about everything that you've heard here on the show. I thank you all so much for joining me. Thank you to Brandon and also to David, who did the wonderful artwork on this book. We are at the end of the show. Join me again here next week at this time. My guest will be Pankaj Amin. And he has been here before. We're going to continue our conversation about how to survive this strange new economy we have. I'm going to leave you now with a piece from Valerie June, a singer, songwriter, and guitarist who is near and dear to my heart. We have had a terrible week, heat wave here in the Northeast and around the United States this week, so I thought it appropriate to play her piece called Rain Dance today. It is from her album, Valerie June and the Tennessee Express. The album is available online at Valerie's website, valeriejune.com, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, June, J-U-N-E.com. Apparently, the song has worked already. It rained a bit outside about an hour ago. It's much cooler, and I'm getting my warning, but it's much cooler outside, and I hope that this is what is in store for us for the rest of the week. So go on out there and get your rain dance on, and have a wonderful week, everybody. Bye for now. Thank you.
moaning, waking up alone, waiting by the phone.